Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
This week on the Writer's Detective Bureau.
New York Times bestselling author and retired Chief Deputy United States Marshal, Mark Cameron.
I'm Adam Richardson, and this is the Writer's Detective Bureau.
Welcome back to episode 108 of the Writer's Detective Bureau, the podcast dedicated to helping authors and screenwriters write professional quality crime-related fiction. Before we get into the interview, I have some patrons that have stuck with me that I need to thank, namely Gold Shield patrons Deborah Dunbar from deborahdunbar.com, Cece Jamison from ccjamison.com, Larry Keaton, Vicky Tharp of vickytharp.com, Chris Ann, Larry Darter, Natalie Borelli, Craig Kingsman of craigkingsman.com, Lynn Vitale, Marco Carocari of marcocarocari.com, Terry Swan, Rob Kearns of Knights Fall Press, and Mariah Stone of mariahstone.com for their support, along with my Silver Cufflink and Coffee Club patrons. You can find links to all of the patrons supporting this episode in the show notes at writersdetective.com/108. To learn more about using Patreon to grow your author business or to support this podcast, check out writersdetective.com/Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Today is a big day. Today marks a pretty big change at the Bureau. Not only is it my triumphant return to the microphone after a particularly nasty and prolonged bout with a sinus infection that I will spare you the details of, today's also my last day as a college instructor. My students have their final exam today, and I've notified the college that after 12 years of teaching, this would be my last semester. It's bittersweet leaving the college that I love, but it's the right move, and it's a move that I made for you, the writers who listen to this podcast. I've been spreading myself too thin to meet all of my commitments to the degree that they deserve, and I chose to follow my passion. So with my last labor-intensive college teaching semester behind me, I have a lot more time to devote to the Bureau. Weekly podcast episodes, more frequent live streams on camera, two new courses coming this summer, more about those next week, and finally, my book, The Writer's Detective Handbook, will launch this fall. Sometimes we have to make room in our lives to accomplish the bigger and better things, and I could not be more excited. Speaking of excited, this is one heck of a special episode. You know I rarely do interviews that don't start with reading a Miranda card, or putting someone under caution, as our more polite international partners might say. But I certainly didn't need to read the rights to this man, because I spent a lot of time reading his books instead, and you should too. So let's please give Mark Cameron a warm welcome to the Writer's Detective Bureau. My guest today is New York Times bestselling author and retired Chief Deputy United States Marshal, Mark Cameron. Mark is the author of the Arliss Cutter series of mystery novels, the New York Times bestselling Jericho Quinn thriller series, and what I can only call the daunting duty of continuing Tom Clancy's legacy by continuing the Jack Ryan campus thriller series of novels. Welcome, Mark, to the Writer's Detective Bureau.
Thanks for having me. Sounds fun.
Thanks for coming on. So we'll get back to those impressive writing chops here in a minute. I wanted to start by asking about the United States Marshal Service. Many of the folks listening right now are outside of the United States. So the word marshal, much like the word sheriff, is not only frequently misspelled, it tends to immediately conjure up a Wild West mental image, like Marshall Dillon of Gunsmoke, or even the recent TV show Justified, which kind of has that Old West lawman feel. How would you describe what the modern United States Marshal Service does? Like, what are their primary responsibilities?
Yeah, so just kind of ticking down the Rotary Club speech here. Our main jobs are to protect the judiciary, to move federal prisoners to and from court and to and from their initial time in prison. So we don't in other words, we don't run jails or prisons ourselves, but when if somebody is taken into custody and found guilty in a trial, you know, in court, then the marshals would be responsible for getting them either via vehicle, you know, like a cage sedan or van, or by what everybody calls Con Air, but the real name for it is the Justice Alien Transportation, so JPAT, Justice Prisoner Alien Transportation System, or JPATs. So there are several aircraft that are involved in that that go on a kind of a specific routes around the country, and deputies would meet those aircraft in vans. And so generally those duties happen early in your career when you're just starting out, you're pulling the hooking and hauling duties and going to, you know, spending a lot more time in court and going on long prisoner trips and things like that. And then as you kind of mature in your career, you can specialize in either witness security program or which is it's competitive. You don't just say, I want to do it. You have to compete with other people because it's a inspector job, which is like a supervisory level. There's judicial security, which has to do with just what it says, you know, protecting judges on a full-time basis. So you might protect Supreme Court justices, or because they get protection all the time when they're outside the beltway. But then regular United States district judge would get protection when he or she has a bona fide threat, and Marshal Service looks at those threats and sort of uses a specific matrix on when a threat needs to become a protective detail. So there, and that's what I actually specialized in early in my career, was judicial protection. And then we have our own special operations group, which is like a SWAT team, but for the Marshal Service. And there's a couple of full-time elements, and then deputies that work out in the districts, and then they're called in during specific assignments. And then there's full-time fugitive work, which I also specialized in during part of the time, just running the fugitive task forces, which are anybody that's in law enforcement has seen probably somebody from their agency is either their agency or a sheriff's department near them or city has helped out with a task force. Some agencies do it on an ad hoc basis, just depends on who we're after. Other ones supply, like here in Anchorage, for instance, Anchorage PD and the state troopers have folks on our task force full time. So it's housed in Marshal Service space. We provide the overtime and things like that, and gas for their cars and all of that, sort of as an incentive to the agencies to put them over in the task force. And then we don't just look for federal fugitives. They can bring their, you know, village terrorists, if you will, the worst of the worst, the ones they really want to focus on. And then we, as in task force fashion, will focus on those state and local warrants as well. So that's probably the sexiest job, that, you know, the justified Tommy Lee Jones fugitive U.S. Marshals kind of gig. And it probably, for some people in their career, it can make up the bulk of their career. For your rank and file deputy marshal, that's probably 30% of a career is fugitive hunting. So a little bit of everything. We're very fortunate in that our credential, instead of saying enforce U.S. code, you know, 18 U.S.C., whatever, for either drug crimes or firearms or tax crimes or whatever, the United States Marshal's credential says enforce federal law, which means everything. So if for instance, I guess the best way to explain what we really are, people in the United States always say we're the sheriffs for the federal government. Somebody overseas might not understand that. So just a really 20-second civics lesson, there's three branches of the federal government: the judicial, the legislative, and the executive. The Marshal Service, although we're the part of the executive branch, we execute warrants, we're the enforcement side, we actually work very closely with the judicial branch, because if a judge, for instance, says, you know, bangs his or her gavel and says, I want so-and-so in court, They have no way to get that person to court. Some person has to be the muscle. And so the best way to think about what the Marshal Service is although we're an executive branch, we are the muscle for the judicial branch. So that's why we call ourselves we're often described as the enforcement agency within the Department of Justice, where the FBI is an investigative agency within the Department of Justice. The Marshal Service, any process, any paper that comes across the bench from U.S. courts that has to have enforcement action is enforced by Deputy United States Marshals. So whether it's seizing ill-gotten gains after a drug investigation, whether it's arresting someone on a fugitive warrant, whether it's going and picking up a juror that's scoffing at the judge and not coming to jury duty, or just serving somebody a summons or subpoena, any civil process or criminal process that comes across from the bench is enforced by us.
Yeah, having worked with quite a few agents from other federal agencies where they're quote unquote special agents, I always learned that special agent actually was more of a limitation as far as they were stuck with the whatever their legal purview was. So it sounds to me that it's actually a benefit of being a deputy U.S. Marshal of not having special in your name gives you kind of that catch-all to enforce pretty much anything that comes across your plate.
Yeah, the Attorney General can actually, because we also have, because of the way we were formed in 1789, we have by statute the powers of a sheriff. So, and those were defined, back from England, British times. And so we have the power to, for instance, deputize. So that's why when you see whether there's big riots somewhere or a huge event like a Super Bowl or the Olympics, they bring in deputy marshals, and then state and local people, there's not enough. For instance, I worked in the Salt Lake City Olympics, the Winter Olympics. They brought in, I don't know how many, a couple of hundred of us, but that wasn't enough people. And we were assigned to the Secret Service. They handled the logistics. But deputy marshals had to go in, and some people from our headquarters came in and swore in all the other state and local people that didn't have authority in Salt Lake City, but we did. And so we made them special deputy marshals basically raised a posse for the duration of the Olympics. And then they could enforce laws within that jurisdiction, which wasn't normally their own. So we have that authority. If early in my career, we had a big hurricane in Miami, Hurricane Andrew, which blew away Homestead, Florida, and Florida City, and some of the it was a huge hurricane. And I remember I was in Texas roofing a lady's house, a neighbor's house, and my pager went off, and they said, "You need to be on a plane to Miami tomorrow or by tonight, so it could be there tomorrow." So we had state and local people that we were deputizing there, and then the Attorney General just said, law enforcement's having trouble in Miami, send in the marshals. Before my time, a couple of years before my time, there were strikes in West Virginia with coal miners, and there was some violence going on. They sent in the marshals. So we have kind of a history of a big storm came through the Virgin Islands, blew a prison down, and all the prisoners escaped. So they sent in the marshals. So it's because of that, it's a really interesting job because you never know what it's going to be. You have to resign. Every job has its downside. Reports and reports are not really a problem in the Marshal Service because we're a enforcement agency. It's really obviously if there's some violence or, use your taser, or there's a officer involved shooting or whatever, you have to write a report. But our reports are very short, to the point. This is who we were after. This is who we arrested. This is what time of day it was. This is who was there. Amen. Send it on. Go out and get the next person.
Soft felon, arrested, same.
Yeah, exactly. Weather, cloudy kind of a thing. So that's the sitting in court. That's our downside. But we don't have FBI or other agencies. My eldest son was a OSI agent for a number of years in the Air Force, and he's a physician now, but he would tell me all the, you know, it's just so report heavy, so much paperwork you have to do. And, you know, so everybody has the downside, but in the Marshal Service, even though you have that court you have to deal with and maybe babysitting a prisoner at the hospital, the upside is phenomenal. The being able to go work a fugitive strike team in on the border for 10 weeks where they pair you with a state or local person and hand you a stack of warrants and say, see you in 6 weeks and we'll go over what you got and give you some more, you know? And so it's for a certain type of individual, it's a pretty cool job.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a very cool job.
Especially when you have a boss that gives you the autonomy to go forth and conquer and not be micromanaged all the time. And it was fascinating learning that history as far as kind of recognizing the Marshal Service as almost the federal version of a sheriff with that posse comitatus kind of power. Where we saw it, or as a local guy, being assigned to a federal task force, whether that's FBI, you know, violent crime or joint terrorism task force,
like Safe Streets,
or even a DEA task force, the local agents or the local cops are the ones that get that special deputy U.S. Marshal credential, essentially, to be able to then enforce federal law and get federal warrants as part of that. But interesting to learn the history of that.
Yeah, it's pretty fun backstory that a lot of Marshal Service has never been very good about tooting our own horn. We when I hired on in the, I came on the Marshal Service in 91, and back then I can't remember who was first, but the two big rental car companies, Hertz and Avis, were like battling it out for number one, and whichever one it was, I think it was Avis, and they were like, we're number two, so we try harder. And that was our motto. We were like, we're number two in the Justice Department, so we try harder. We want to be better. And it was kind of, we gloried in the fact that we were the kind of the knuckle dragging underdogs in the Justice Department. But we were arresting more fugitives and still do arrest more fugitives than all the other federal law enforcement agencies combined, because we focus on that. It's not to demean what the other people do. They could, they just have other duties. And we really pride ourselves in that expertise of being manhunters.
That's awesome. So several of my writers, upon learning that I was going to be interviewing you, had questions, obviously, about the Marshal's WITSEC or Witness Protection Program, which you touched on briefly. And I'm sure you get questions about this all the time. So without obviously divulging sensitive information, what suggestions do you have for writers that want to include WITSEC in their stories and have it be believable?
Yeah, so that is, you're right. That's a question that comes up quite often. And I would say that there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is there are some things out there that I can't even talk about, even though they're in the public domain and, you know, they're in open source. But because I know about it from the Marshal Service, I'm not allowed to talk about it. The main thing that people need to remember, two things really. One, people that handle the witness security program, we call it WITSEC, or witness security, or the program, those are called inspectors. They're deputy marshals, but they have the rank of inspector. That's not secret. Mary Shannon on In Plain Sight or whatever, Mary McCormick, they do a good job. I'm pretty sure we had consultants on that show about the witness security program. So they have the same badge as us, they carry the same gun as us. But when somebody, and it's a competitive job, you come up through the ranks as a deputy, you go to the same training as a deputy. I mean, you are a deputy marshal. We call them DUSMs, D-U-S-Ms, just a deputy U.S. marshal. Or sometimes, jokingly, we call them pods, just a plain old deputy. They're not specialized in anything yet. So a DUSM or a plain old deputy does their work, all the things we talked about. Then they see on the computer, they call it impromo, merit promotion. Impromo thing will come across the computer, an email, and say, these are the openings that come along, WITSEC inspector, so-and-so. But even then, they're vague about even to the rank and file, they're vague about, you know, what part of the country. But then the people compete. There's And it depends on the year. Sometimes they bring you in for interviews. Sometimes it's on the phone. Sometimes they just look at your background and talk to your bosses. But once you win that position, once you earn that position and you're put in that position, you go to more training and you really fall off the phone book. You're part of the Marshal Service, but you, and so as a brand new deputy marshal, as a brand new deputy U.S. Marshal, there's certain things that you need to do as part of your career advancement. Now, we don't have a field training officer program like they do in a uniform thing that's, where somebody's assigned to you and you get marked down or every day or they try to run you off or hazy or whatever. We don't have that. When you leave Federal Law Enforcement Training Center and then the Marshal Service Academy, you come on and you hit the ground running and you might be assigned with a jail guard, maybe a retired DEA agent to go pick up a bunch of prisoners. They expect you to know how to do that already. You do have a senior deputy that's sort of your mentor, your rabbi or bhagwan or whatever you want to call him. But then during the first 3 years of your career, the headquarters wants to know that you have X number of weeks doing fugitive operations, X number of weeks seizing some sort of assets, seizing civil or criminal ill-gotten gains assets, so much time doing witness security. So during that time, you'll get assigned at some point to a witness security assignment as a post-stander or working with an inspector or producing someone for court, all the open stuff that everybody knows about. If you're in witness, if you're on the program, you're going to have to testify. That's part of being on the program. And they need deputies to help bring all those people in. So it's just like a Secret Service detail, if you will, a protective detail, but on our protected witness. Sometimes they're in custody. Sometimes they're out, it's not a secret to say that by and large, the person on the actual protectee is really the first rat to the trough. It's not like rarely is it some beautiful bookkeeper that just happened to overhear a criminal act. These are other criminals that made a deal, and that's why they're on the program, right? So the deputies early in their career, that's their taste of witness security. So when a writer is writing about it, they can have a deputy helping out or whatever, but the inspectors are the ones that doing it are actually the day-to-day mission. Now, the part I can't talk about is what goes on, where people are assigned, what the inspectors are doing, how they set them up. A lot of questions are how they set them up with new identities. There's a good discovery program about that, and watch that. But it's much like, I have friends that are retired Central Intelligence Agency, okay? So when I write the Tom Clancy books or the Jericho books, if I want to nudge on CIA, I can take what I know, and that's enough to send me to, because some stuff they just can't talk about. But it sends me to the open source things that I can Google and videos I can look at and things like that. And I think Sammy the Bull has even talked about it. He was on witness security in New Mexico and then was started selling drugs and ended up getting kicked off the program. So it's not, I think he's talked about what the program is like a little bit because he got mad. So you can glean some of those things. But the reality of it is, some parts of it are so secret, sensitive, that you can make stuff up. Nobody's going to call you on it. Really, if you think about it, if you wanted to hide someone and you used your common sense about how to hide someone, break them off from their regular life, they don't have any contact with that anymore, how would you do it and put a WITSEC inspector in charge of that? A good book to read is, I've got it here. I've got it signed. My son may have borrowed it, but the, Joe Pistone.
Oh yeah. Donnie Brasco.
Donnie Brasco. So, I've got a signed copy and he teaches undercover work and all that. Well, you just read about what they did, and it wasn't witness security, but what they did to protect him. It's really kind of common sense. And so as long as a writer will put it in the milieu of the Marshal Service, so often it's the FBI. And we're like, okay, say that if you want to, but that's not right. Put it in the Marshal Service. Also, to remember that nobody on the program that kept the rules has ever been killed. And so when you write about it, if a witness is killed, I mean, it's fiction. You're going to do your thing. But the reality of it is, if it gets exciting in WITSEC, somebody's made an error. It's very low key. That's what makes it secure, is when you just have so many layers between the protectee and his or her background that it just should never be. I mean, for instance, if you have your protective people wearing, well, your people study police work, like shoot me first vests, like a vest that screams police or law enforcement, or Royal Robbins shirts or pants, or, you know, 5'11 pants. That is not the way to run a WITSEC detail. So your person shouldn't, when you're writing about somebody that's doing any kind of protection that's low profile, tactical is not the way to go. You should look, in fact, as a retired guy who, I mean, I'm a gun guy. I carry concealed and all that. I very rarely talk about that online. Nobody's going to see, for instance, where I carry or what kind of holster or anything like that. If I show that online, it's because I'm switching to a different way of doing it. That's just not tactical to me to blurt that out to the world. And so I bring some of my knowledge from that, from my job, and I would rather be a tactical grandpa when I'm out with my grandkids where people don't know who I am. If they ever, you know, I had a well-meaning friend say, you know, if somebody tries to attack you, you pull your knife and kind of threaten them. And I said, nope. If anybody ever sees my knife, it's after I've stabbed them 9 times. You know, I mean, and I'm not a knife guy when it comes to that. I'm just, my point is, you don't brandish things. You don't, and the same goes with your uniform, your daily tactical Oakleys and Royal Robins or 5'11. I'm dating myself calling Royal Robins, but 5'11s or whatever. And so when you're writing about somebody that's doing judicial protection, witness security, whatever, they just need to blend in as if you were writing about a covert op, because that's what it is.
Yeah. Awesome.
Does that make sense? Is that enough? I'm saying a lot without saying much.
Which is perfect. I'm sure that's what the program would hope for. Definitely. I mean, I think the, you know, put yourself in that position as a writer and mm-hmm. what would you do logically and see where that takes you.
Nobody's going to call you on it. There's not going to be anybody from the Marshal Service that goes, no, we don't do it that way. Sorry, you've made a big error.
Right.
So you'll be fine. As long as it doesn't, you know, it's like any other kind of research. You're really doing the research so you don't get it wrong. Not, you don't have to have all the right components. Just don't put it with the Bureau or have them carry a different kind of pistol than the Marshal Service regular deputies do or whatever. Just realize it's, and you can get that from open source.
So out of all of the assignments that you had, which one was your favorite?
You know, I really enjoyed, I enjoyed protective work a lot. I enjoyed right after the first World Trade Center bombing, we moved, when I first went there, we were moving Ramzi Youssef back and forth to court. And then I was assigned to Judge Mukasey's wife, who handled he was one of the judges handling the trial. Judge Mukasey later became the attorney general. But so I was on a protective detail for his wife, and she was very active in town. Like she was on a softball shider. I mean, it was just very interesting to me to do protective work. So I enjoyed that. A lot of times we, as deputy marshals, since we're trained with protection, we get assigned to the Department of State Diplomatic Security. And so several times over my career, I was assigned during the United Nations General Assembly to protect. At one point for several weeks, I did the Japanese foreign minister. And then another time I did the Chinese foreign minister, India, Egypt, did Egypt for a while. But the Chinese one was the most interesting to me because it was, we did it twice. It was the 50th anniversary UN gala, and then they had us come back for the regular General Assembly, or the other way around. I can't remember. But we did, we went home, and if they, basically if they liked you on the detail, they brought you back. And at the end of that one, at that point I was in Idaho, assigned to the Marshal Service in Idaho. And at the end of that one, the DS agent came to me and said, hey, it was the time when the Dayton Peace Accords were going on. And they said, all we need all our DS agents, diplomatic security agents, for the Dayton Peace Accords. But the Chinese version of Air Force One needs one of us on it. There's going to be some Secret Service agents and a DS agent. You work for us. Would you mind flying with it as far as Alaska? And Deng Xiaoping was the president, or I think that was who it was the president or the premier of China at the time. And so it was his airplane. The foreign minister was the vice premier, vice president. They have like a dual role. So I was on there for him while we were in U.S. airspace. So we flew from New York, landed in Anchorage, but that whole thing, we got brought up to the front, and the premier of China, you know, the top guy that I'd seen on the news, and he gave me a tie, and I was only on the detail for minutes on his, you know, just a few hours on his airplane. I was on his underlings detail, but just seeing as a writer, and I knew I was writing at the time. At that point, I was still writing Westerns, but I knew I wanted to break into thrillers, and being able to be on China's aircraft, being able to hang out behind the walls of the UN and watch the, what I know is, you know, and out on the streets watching some espionage go down and, you know, little things like that. It was really thriller writer 101 and just being a fly on the wall. And so I really enjoyed those details.
That's amazing. So what would you, just looking back, if one comes off the top of your head, what would you say was the best day of your career?
Well, that's a hard question. That I, maybe graduating the academy. I mean, it's such a, I had a, my youngest son, who's a police officer here in Anchorage, was born while I was in the academy. And so I that was probably the best day. I was, of course, you know, I knew he was coming along. I went to the academy. She was 7.5 months pregnant. And so we were out on a fun run, which is like, they call them fun runs, but like 8 to 10 mile runs, depending on how the instructor feels.
How much fun they wanted you to have.
Yeah, exactly. You're running in formation and the instructors know how far they're running. So they pace themselves. The rest of your, you know, trying to stay in formation and you're singing cadence and they run you past the gym and, you know, you think you're home, but you're not home. And, you know, the same kind of mind games that everybody, every academy plays. And my wife at 8 months, right, I guess, I think 3 weeks before she was due, they decided to go ahead and take the baby. And this was before cell phones. So I called once a week on the bank of pay phones, you know, and at FLETC at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. So I really wasn't up to speed of what was going on. And this limousine and a little golf cart that we had, these armored limousines we practiced with for driving and things like that, it pulled up next to our fun run back in the woods in Georgia and said, fall out, we're having a baby. And I jumped in the car and they took me back to the infamous Building 20, which is Marshal Service headquarters at the academy, but no recruits ever go there. So I got to go in Building 20 and talk to my wife, and she told me the baby was okay, just 3 weeks early, but he's doing fine. And very short talk, and then the instructors all said, so you quitting? And I said, no, I knew it was going to happen. I'm sticking it out. And so then they drove me back out, and I ran the last 4 miles with my class, and that was a pretty dang good day. Last 4 miles went pretty sweet. But then when you graduate, you know, I wanted to be a deputy marshal much of my law enforcement, well, my whole law enforcement life, but really since I was about 14 when I met one. And, you know, a real one, not the Hollywoodized version, although he was kind of the Hollywoodized version. But And as it happened, he was the one that did my background. The guy that I'd met when I was 14, he did my background for the job. But so when they graduate, you get a diploma, of course, but they have your credentials all stacked up on a table. And the Marshal Service credentials are they're different than some in that our badge is on the outside of the credentials. So you when you open it up, it's your actual credentials. The badge is in a cutout on the outside. So it's all stacked up on the table with all these open credentials with a circle star. And it was when they call you up and they give you that and you realize you really are this deputy U.S. Marshal you've really always wanted to be. That was pretty amazing to me.
That's awesome. I would definitely say that my academy graduation was definitely one of the not just
it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with all the blood, sweat, and tears that you put into trying to get through that thing in one piece.
Exactly.
So while you were active with the Marshals Service, what did your everyday carry, your EDC look like? What did you carry on you?
So a little bit of everything. When I went through the academy, and again, I'm dating myself like Royal Robbins, I carried a 686 revolver when I was with the police department. And then when I hired on with the Marshals, they were issuing Smith & Wesson model 66s, but we shot so much that some of the screws were backing out of the adjustable sights. And so they went to the Ruger GP100, which was a great revolver, but it is a boat anchor. I mean, you can't, there's no adjustable sight. It looks like the old, what the FBI used to shoot years ago, the Model 13, just the ramp rear sight and just a snubby 3-inch barrel. So we shot with the GP100, which was a good enough gun. And I was sure happy to get it on graduation day when you go by and they pass them all out to you and you actually get to fly home armed on the airplane for the first time and all of that. Kind of a rite of passage. But as soon as I got back home, I always wanted a .45 when I was with the patrol. In fact, I lobbied with our police department, with our chief, to get the right to carry semi-autos, but I left before they allowed you to carry semi-autos. And so when I got home, I carried a .45-06, a Smith & Wesson .45-06. And then I realized that I really liked revolvers, and this is kind of embarrassing, but I had my partner at the time, just a super guy, an incredible lawman named John Moore. He's not very tall. In fact, everybody called him too tall, but he is not a very tall guy, but he made up for it in personality. And he talked with those really low Clint Eastwood kind of whispers, and you knew he would kill you if you messed up. I mean, he was just former Vietnam 173rd, just a no nonsense kind of guy, but the best fugitive hunter I've ever been around. So he's my first partner, and he carried a .357 revolver that he named Becky Sue, and it was beautiful blue, like the same kind of bluing as a Colt Python, except this was aftermarket bluing. And then it had Mexican like 3-tone gold grips. Certainly not tactical as far as sweaty, but man, they were pretty. And the cylinder was nickel, the hammer and the trigger were gold, and it was just this outlandish. But the guy could shoot aspirin out of the air. I mean, he was just an incredible. I could shoot okay, but my targets had like fist size holes in the middle of them. His were like 9 holes wide with all 60 rounds of ammo. So I just thought, man, if John carries a revolver, I want to carry a revolver. So I ended up buying a .44 Special. Couldn't carry a Magnum unless it was a .357 Magnum. I bought a round butt 3-inch .44 or 2.5-inch .44 Special. I can't remember what it's called, 624 or something like that. And I got perlite grips, and I embedded a Marshal Service star on either side of it. So, and I polished the stainless so that it looked like a mirror, because that's what John did with his, you know. And so when we would go to, and I carried that for years, I carried that up into Idaho when I transferred to Idaho. And we'd go. I remember going to Walla Walla, a state prison in Washington. We were taking prisoners across from Idaho over to. We were actually going to drop them in Oregon, but we had to go drop somebody in Walla Walla. And Walla Walla is one of those prisons. I don't know what it's like now, but back then, when you pulled into the little no man's land gated sally port, mm-hmm. and then their guard shack, the tower, they just lowered a canvas bucket down, and then you put your guns all in that bucket, and guns and knives and whatever. My partner at that time was a guy named Denny Szczynski, former Army Ranger, SOG, our Special Operations Group commander, another just fantastic partner to have. So he was carrying a 45 and five or six knives and a push dagger. I mean, he was like the Raylan Givens of his time, and humongous mustache. They wouldn't let me grow a beard, but Denny had a yard and a half long curly mustache. But so we put our guns in the bucket, and then we were going through, and I looked up as we were pulling away, and I had a little short, we call it a Witsec shotgun, the little 11-inch 870 that now they call them a TAC 14. I have one now. They're legal. But ours was shorter even than that. And so I had that, my 624 that I named Clarice because John named his Becky Sue. And they had them all lined out. We could see them up on the tower, and they were looking at our guns and knives. And I thought, yep, I've arrived. They're interested in what I'm carrying. After that, I kind of grew up and carrying kind of became a little more taciturn, and I carried a SIG 229 carried that through the latter part of Idaho and all through my career until they made us go to Glocks, and then they mandated a Glock and
carried a Glock. So it was back then, were you able to carry what you wanted then, and then mm-hmm. they became department wide you shall carry?
Yeah, sometime after 9/11, I can't even remember when, I want to say it was like 2004 or something like that, they mandated a Glock 40 caliber, and you could carry it. We were issued the Model 22, the bigger 40 cal. I was a judicial security inspector, so I specialized in protection. Everybody's plain clothes, but in their infinite wisdom, our headquarters said all deputy marshals get a Glock 22, except marshals, the presidential appointee, and judicial security inspectors, and you guys get the 23, the mid-size one. I don't know why they did it, but I ended up with a 23. But then one of the young lady deputies in our office, I was the chief. I promoted to chief, and she was having a little, the bigger gun was a little bit large for her hand size and her body size concealing the Model 22. And so I swapped with her. But then as the chief, I carried the smaller 27 and kept the 22 in the safe most of the time. So, but we had to go to Glocks. And in fact, that's part of the shtick, if you will, or the character of Arliss Cutter in my new books, is that his grandfather was a Florida Marine Patrol officer who carries a Colt Python. We could carry, even now, we can carry whatever we want within that 357 Magnum or 380 basically up to a 357 Magnum or a 44 Special or a 45 ACP, just not 44 Magnum or something like that, as a backup gun. And so in the books, he has a little small Glock 27 he keeps over his kidney that's his policy gun, and his backup gun is his grandfather's Colt Python that he carries on his hip.
That's awesome. So, which brings us to one of my favorite characters, even though he's actually off camera as a mentor, if you will, mm-hmm. But Grumpy Cutter. So yeah. who was Grumpy, and, or who is Grumpy, I guess, and what is your personal favorite rule of his?
Well, I think Grumpy is a mixture of the guy I told you about, John, my own grandfather, the lawmen that I knew growing up, you know, the really that, and oftentimes Grumpy is me. Grumpy's the, I have two grandsons. I have five grandkids, and two of my oldest two are, they're 15 months apart, but they look like twins. And one has a little darker hair. One is blonde, really white blonde hair. you know, like toe-headed hair. And so I really based the two twins on my grandsons, and I try to teach them to be good young men, to be good people. And so the things that I've learned over the years from my mentors, my grandpa, and my grandma, for that matter, I just sort of mushed them all together and made those grumpyisms. And you can't see it, but behind me, I've got like, I don't know, 30 small Moleskine notebooks that I've just filled up over the years with. Somebody would say something cool, and I'd write it down, and I have a lot of grumpyisms. I think I don't know that I have a favorite. I keep coming up with them all the time, but I'm gleaning them even now, when I hear something that I would want to pass on to my grandkids, my granddaughter or my grandsons, or my own kids. Just things that, that stand up when somebody shakes your hand, look them in the eye. Probably the one that I quote the most often is, let no guilty man go free. That's in the next book, the one that it's number four, it's just turned in. I actually flash back to Grumpy. We get to meet Grumpy.
Awesome.
When the boys are very young, in Florida, and he's leaving. And, he talks about how sometimes you just have to go right at a thing. You can't wait around at it. You got to just attack it head on. And so I try to basically, if I'm hanging around with my grandsons and I see that they need some correction, that ends up in a book, and I write a grumpy rule for it. But I'm certainly not smart enough to make them up myself. I'm stealing it from smart men and women that I know.
As it should be. Another recurring character is Arliss's subordinate, Deputy U.S. Marshal Lola. Now, I'm going to ask for help on the pronunciation, because in one of the books you talk about how the proper pronunciation of her last name. How do you pronounce it?
Yeah, it's Cook Island Maori. So it's a R like a Japanese or a Spanish R, a hard R. Instead of a R, it's a D R. So Te Ariki. So almost if you said Te Ariki, like a D, but it's some people, when they read it, they say teriyaki, but it's a Lola Te Ariki. And it just means the Ariki, or the Ariki, A-R-I-K-I, means chief. So on the island, my wife and I go to Rarotonga every winter, spend a couple of months there. We have some wonderful friends there. The Ariki is the chief. So the Te Ariki just means the big chief. So the chief. And I'd named that character, and then we were talking to some people that run a resort there, and her last name is Te Ariki.
Oh, wow.
So she's become and oddly enough, I'd known her from taking our family over to this resort. I just knew her. Her name's Naomi. And her maiden name is Te Ariki. So when I showed her the book, she was like, oh, my gosh, I'm a Te Ariki. And I had actually based some of Lola's mannerism stuff on Naomi and this other gal that works with her named Vicky and some of the other. They're just such larger-than-life, interesting, fun-loving, but tough people, the men and women there, that they're just such a great culture. And they speak with a really marvelous Kiwi accent, a New Zealand accent. And so since they speak English, sometimes we think, they think like I do, but they have a different way of approaching things. And, they're like Australians and Kiwis are in many ways much kinder than we are in the way they think of things in life. And it's been a great learning experience. So she has that culture. Her father was Cook Island Lola's father was Cook Island Maori. She can approach where Arliss is really taciturn. He's grumpy, basically. I think there's a line in one of the books where somebody talks about him being a grumpy cutter, and he says, "Well, he can be a grumpy cutter, but there's only one grumpy cutter." But he just doesn't smile much. Where Lola is just smiling and happy and just like my Cook Island friends. And so it's been really fun to get to know her character better and have her as a foil for Arliss and him for her. So he can teach her about tracking. He can show her, even though he's from Florida and she's been in Alaska for a few months longer than him, she can say, well, this is what it's like over there. And he can say, all right, well, I don't know what it's like in Fairbanks, but I know what it's like to track a bad guy over the ground. And he can teach her that. So it's a fun way as a writer to teach the reader bits and pieces of man hunting, man tracking, as Arliss teaches her, and then also talk about humanity and how we should be as law enforcement as she softens Arliss's rough edges.
And then the way you speak of both of them, they sound, I mean, as a reader, obviously they come to life, you know, like I can anticipate, like if you were to read a line, I could tell which character it was just by their voice or what they were saying. So
good. Thank you.
Yeah. It's amazing work on your part. So my question is, and I know a lot of writers kind of feel like that their characters take on a life of their own beyond what the plot would necessarily call for. Mm-hmm. So as the creator of this world, do they ever talk to you as far as, I mean, it sounds weird to say it like that, but like, do they ever surprise you in how all of a sudden they're telling you what they would really do?
Well, I think the way I write, I wouldn't say they talk to me, but they certainly, what I try to do is rather than come up with a thing for my characters to do, I try to come up with the plot in that the first thing I do is figure out what the bad guys are trying to get done. So I write a timeline of what are the bad guys doing? Here's what they're trying to make happen. Here's the methods they're going to go. Here's their fiendish plot. And then how can my good guys, my protagonists, intersect with that fiendish plot? And so I create the world, and I'll fill up three or four legal pads of just that. Here, what if they did this? What if they did that? And you want the bad guys to be as smart as you can so that your good guys have to work harder, right? And so then I plunk Arliss and Lola down in that world, and I feel like I know them well enough that I'm not directing them. I'm allowing them. What my direction is building their characters. And so if I know, for instance, that Arliss would lose his temper in this situation, I better make sure Lola's there beside him, or he's going to do something that's going to cost him his job or worse, right, with this bad behavior. And so I wouldn't say that they talk back to me, but they certainly sometimes I'm surprised. I go, oh, yeah, that's right. That's what she would do. That's, you know, I'm writing along or I'll get to a point where I think this just isn't working. And the reason it's not working is because I'm trying to make a character do something that's against their character, do something against their makeup. And then it feels wrong. It feels tinny. There's a character in the early Jericho books named Veronica Garcia. And when I first wrote her, I wrote her as a sacrificial lamb, like the Bond girl that dies, right? She's a CIA uniform officer. She's supposed to stop shooting an active shooter or a couple of active shooters at Langley, at the George Bush Centers for Intelligence. And so we meet her. She's getting out of the shower from working out in the gym, and she just wants friends so bad. And I want to make her this character that's not just a badass, but a human being, but also a badass. So she's getting dressed. She's trying to be friends with somebody that's an analyst, but in CIA, you know, you're careful who your friends are. And then she gets involved in the shooting and she's supposed to die. In my original plot, she's just a really cool person that's sacrificed, and it makes us see how bad the people are. Well, she's been in every book and she's now Jericho's love interest because her care, if I made her that much of a tactician, she couldn't lose. She did the right job. She was damaged, but then I just liked her too much, and she became too strong a character for me to write off the page. And as I said, she appeared in the second Jericho, and she's been in every one of them since.
That's awesome. So, and to get to your career, now that we've talked about Jericho, we've talked about the Arliss Cutter series. Of course, we've had mentioned earlier the enormous weight of taking on the world and legacy of Tom Clancy's stuff. Right. So obviously, you've had a hell of a writing career in its own right. Never mind your law enforcement career. So if we were to think back to the beginning of the writing, where in your learning and implementing the craft of storytelling, at what point did it feel like it really clicked? Like, where did you kind of feel like you graduated from amateur to pro with your writing?
Yeah, I think I'm waiting for that day to happen. Maybe I'm pretty self-critical, and my wife always jokes that I love the book I'm about to write and hate the book I'm working on now, and try to not ever talk about the book I just got finished with. I'm pretty hard on myself. I'm not one of those people that likes to read my own writing in an event like this. I just some of my books I like the newest jerk or the newest cutter that's out. I really like the one before that the most of all any book I've ever written is called Stone Cross. Mm-hmm. Not that the other ones are bad. I just, that one's the most, got the most of me in it. I think because of the Marshall Service work and Bush Alaska and all of that. But I wanted to write when I was very young, wrote stories. We took a lot of road trips to visit my grandparents when I was little. And my dad was the kind of guy that didn't like radios on the car. So the car was like quiet for days. And so I took notepads with me and wrote in the back seat of these huge Plymouths or Plymouth Belvedere, whatever they happen to have. My sister did her thing and I wrote, and that was it. So I did a lot of writing, and then as I grew up, got older, I was a horrible student because I would be studying physics when I should have been studying history, and then studying about, rockets or whatever, studying, memorizing Hamlet when I should have been doing biology. I was just all over the place, and I wouldn't say that I had attention deficit, but I just didn't care, and I wanted to study what I wanted to study. And so but my dad, I was really into theater at the time and kind of a weirdo, really an odd kid, I think, but it turned out good because I met my wife in the theater. But I really wanted to be in school plays. And my dad said, if you don't make straight A's, you're not doing any after school stuff, no track, no theater, no nothing. And so I really busted my butt during my junior year. I wanted to graduate early and move to Alaska. And so I was taking summer school and all of that. And I figured if I made C's, that was good enough. But my dad was a school teacher, and so he wanted me to make A's, and I made A's in every class except at that time. I was a junior, but I was taking senior English, and Miss Skidmore was the hardest teacher in school. I mean, she was, if I were to put something on Facebook in my Weatherford High School class of 80, no one would disagree with me that she was the hardest English teacher there was, but everybody loved her because she loved us. And I turned in a paper, and I can't remember what it was about. It was a short story. I think something about growing up in my mom growing up in Louisiana and me going back to visit, some kind of a personal essay short story. And she handed it back, and it had red marks all over it. And it was just, this was misspelled. I think I wrote it in pencil when it should have been typed. And she gave me a C-. But at the top, she wrote, "Mark, this looks publishable to me." And it's the only time I ever took a C-minus paper home and showed it to my dad, because Miss Skidmore said that this was a publishable, and it never was. But to me, that was like, okay, I can do this. If she thinks that I can publish this, then, and she actually assigned me, she said, this isn't for a grade. This isn't for you to get extra credit, but I want you to read. It was a Robert Penn Warren book called All the King's Men. And it's a Pulitzer winning novel. It's a big old honking thick novel. It's about, loosely based on Huey Long, the governor of Louisiana back in the 20s. And, but it's, there's been movies made about it, but it's a really great literary, novel. And she said, I just want you to read it and learn from it and do it. I'm giving you this 'cause I love you, Mark, that kind of thing. So I decided then that I was going to do this for a living. And then wrote for the next 20 years and just got rejection letters every month. And when my wife would, my wife just put up with me. And in fact, I tell the story all the time, but the first year of our marriage, she bought me an American Body Armor ballistic vest, the kind with the armadillo on it and the bullet bouncing off, because they didn't buy them for us back then. So she bought me my first ballistic vest and a Smith Krone electric typewriter that first year, because she knew that's where my passions were. And then to her credit, or just being nice, I don't know why, but she let me spend an hour or two most nights a week just hunched over the typewriter writing silly stories that never got published. And then, like I say, about 20 years later, I got one, and then another one, and then another one. And I don't know that I ever felt anything click, but I really studied, though. I mean, I would go to the bookstore and take my little notebook or the library and write down first lines of every book that I was interested in and see what the author did to hook the reader from the beginning. I bought a bunch of Ken Follett books and read them, The Key to Rebecca, Eye of the Needle, Man from St. Petersburg, or three that I have that are just all lined up with notes and margin notes and highlights, and let's see what he did here and how he did that. And I ended up when I got my literary agent that's been my agent for 17 years now, is Robin Rue with Writer's House, who represents Ken Follett. So it's kind of a cool little moment when I walked into Writer's House the first time, and there's a big painting of Ken Follett with all his characters surrounding him in his study. So if I were to have an aha moment, that would probably be it. When I walked into Writer's House, which is a fantastic literary agency, I'm one of their little fish, I'm sure. They represent Stephanie Meyer and Neil Gaiman and Ken Follett and a bunch of people. Just realizing, okay, I'm a little part of this, but I'm at least a part of this, and kind of jazzes you up.
Definitely. I mean, in having that kind of background, it's almost as if that manifested itself for you. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So cool. What writing advice would you give, not to like a beginning or aspiring writer, but to a writer that's squarely in the middle of their career? So like they're serious about their writing, they have a few books under their belt, they've sold some, mm-hmm. but what advice to give them to try to elevate their game?
Well, I think in this day and age, the advice I would give them or anyone else, two things really. One, go to conferences, network. Really, you realize that your front list sells your back list. So the more books you write, the more notice you're going to get. In fact, I'm a big proponent of not spending a whole lot of time on social media, but writing. We have only so much writing energy, and because I only speak to myself, but like right now I have a book that just came out last Tuesday. So I have to spend a certain amount of time saying, go listen to this podcast, or go, you know, come to this virtual book event, you know, and communicate with my readers. I use social media not to find new readers, because I for one have never bought a book because somebody on Facebook told me to buy a book, but I have readers that follow me. And so I try to basically show them what it's like to live in Alaska and pretend that I'm writing an autobiography, certainly abbreviated, but here's my life. Here's what informs my writing. So get to know their readers better without trying to sell them a book. Give them added value instead of just constantly, here's my new book, please buy it, please buy my book, please buy my book. But give the reader something that's something of value. And by doing that, it's either more written work, not just a snarky Facebook post or Twitter tweet, but writing, you know, give them an essay, give them something that's value where they can say, well, I like the way that person writes, or a podcast or whatever, something that gives them added value. But above all of that advice, whether it's I think it's becoming a lot, but observation is becoming a lost art. We are, as writers, we can be so caught up in social media and our phones that we forget to, for instance, stand at the airport. I was just came back from Texas visiting our grandkids, and I made a conscious effort to keep my phone in my pocket and just watch the people around me. But it's so easy to just be plugged into our phone all the time and live in this virtual world. And the writers that observe, they stand head and shoulders above the writers that are just getting all their information off movies they watched off Netflix. You really don't know what a teenager sounds like if all you listen to is teenagers on Netflix or read about it in a book. You need to be out watching and listening and getting your nose out of your phone. And I think that's something that we all, that I see when I, because I get a lot of manuscripts sent to me saying, can you give me a blurb or whatever? And I've had to start saying no a little bit because I just have too many of my own deadlines. Plus, people get mad if they're like, well, how could you write about the Uyghurs in China? I'm writing about the Uyghurs in China. Well, I didn't steal it from you. I got plenty of my own ideas, right? But I think I see in these manuscripts a definite, some of them, not all of them, certainly, some of them are great, but a lack of observation. Like we've lost the craft of writing some. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's something that I struggle with myself, because I could easily get it, especially when a book's coming out. And I don't read my reviews. That would be my other thing. It's really hard, but I want people to give me reviews. That's great because it helps other readers and it helps the algorithms that get pushed out. But I think it's a error for this is just my opinion. I know that probably most writers read them, but no good can come of it. By the time you get a review, you're probably at least a book. I'm two books past that. So I'm not going to go back and change anything. And all it can do is either make me feel puffed up because they like it or sad because they don't like it. And my time is much better spent writing than getting on. But I could get on this endless loop where I checked Goodreads, I checked Amazon, I answered an email, then went to Twitter, and then went to Instagram, then went to Facebook. And by then, somebody else has tweeted, and then somebody else has sent me another email. And I could spend all morning and never plow the same ground twice, but I'd also never get any writing done. And so I think that's really important that we focus on the craft and just keep writing, just keep putting out good quality stories at the best you can. We're all going to have stinkers. That's just part of life, but just keep doing it.
Well, I, for one, really enjoy your writing. In the first book, Open Carry, we meet Arliss and Lola as they start on a fugitive hunt. At the start of Stone Cross, those two are assigned to a judicial protection detail. And then in your latest novel, Bone Rattle, give us a teaser. What's next for Arliss and Lola?
Yeah, so they start off in Bone Rattle. They start off on another arrest on a task force fugitive in Anchorage. It's springtime. It's everything's melting and dusty and, you know, Arliss is kind of getting used to Alaska still. And then they end up going on a sequestered jury to work a sequestered jury down in Juneau in our state capital. There's a kind of a joke about Southeast Alaska, Juneau specifically, that, it's our state capital, but you can't drive to it. So they joke that there's only three ways to get to Juneau, either by plane, boat, or birth canal. And so it's really kind of isolated, which makes people that are prone to conspiracy theories wonder what our politicians are doing down there, you know? And so I just have some evil politicians and basically an archaeological find that happens to stall a gold mine development and the bad guys that are trying to make sure that that's not stalled and find the evil politicians and Lola. And one of the things that we started kind of in the beginning talking about Marshal Service duties. And one of the fun things about these Arliss Cutter novels is that even though we don't investigate murders, it's not at all uncommon for us to be in a place in Alaska specifically where we're the only people out there with the troopers and the troopers will say, hey, help us out. And that's generally how I have in these books. It's not really, not only is it possible, but it's probable that deputy marshals, if they're out in that part of the world, when something happens with their expertise, they'll jump in and help. And that's what I try to, in this one, in Bone Rattle, it's that. In Cold Snap, it has to do with something as the next one that comes out next year, that's done already. It has to do with prisoner transport in the wilds of Alaska. So I try to hit something about, a lot of people don't realize how many different Native cultures there are in Alaska. So it's fun for me to write different parts of Alaska, different Native, the vastly different Native cultures in Alaska, whether it's Yupik or Inupiaq up on the, you know, Barrow, or Athabascan, or in Bone Rattle, or Open Carry, it's Tlingit down in southeast Alaska, that kind of the totem pole Haida, Tlingit native, so native Alaska native. So I like to hit that, and also some little something that the Marshall Service actually does. We rub up against fugitive work, judicial protection, sequestered juries, transporting prisoners, and then of course they get mixed up in a murder.
Oh, that's awesome. And I'm really looking forward to checking this one out. So again, the latest book is Bone Rattle by our guest, New York Times bestselling author, Mark Cameron. Bone Rattle is available now at markcameronbooks.com and wherever books are sold. Thanks so much for coming on the Bureau.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it. It was great fun.
Thanks so much for listening this week, and thanks to Mark for joining us here in the Bureau. This show is powered by your questions. Send them to me by going to writersdetective.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening. Have a great week, and write well.